DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
In this edition, indigenous tribal groups around the world are increasingly under threat.
All over the world, indigenous peoples are increasingly seeing their territories being invaded. They're being targeted by logging companies, multinational oil and gas companies, settlers, ranchers, all sorts of people. So this is certainly not development for them.
Girls dropping out of school as they reach puberty in India, and teaching ancient melodies in Cambodia.
Cambodian culture and art has almost been always an oral transmission. When a master passes away with his skill, then it's the whole art form that is dying.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. August the 9th marks the International Day of Indigenous Peoples. It's intended to highlight the plight of more than 5,000 different indigenous groups around the world. Among these 350 million indigenous are some 150 million tribal people. Tribal people still live in their own communities, following their own ancient traditions and speaking their own languages, often in close contact to nature. However, despite a UN declaration on indigenous people, which calls for the protection of such groups, tribal groups face a lot of pressure because many others wish to gain control of their land. For instance, in Brazil, where a mining company is trying to expand a railroad line that already cuts through the rainforest that's home to the Awá people. The Awá have been called the world's most endangered tribe. A judge last week stopped this railroad project, but the mining company that wants the railroad is planning to appeal. I asked Fiona Watson, London field director from the organization Survival International, what that railroad means to the Awá.
Well, the Awá have told us they are absolutely against the doubling of this railway line. Already the original line, when it was put in the 1980s, funded by the European Community, has cut through their lands and brought untold misery and disaster. The railway in those days acted like a road, so it attracted settlers and cattle ranchers who invaded Awá land, leaving the Awá people absolutely devastated. So it was catastrophic for them. What they say to us now is that after the building of the railway line, those Awá who survived the onslaught have found it incredibly difficult to hunt. They are a nomadic hunter-gatherer people who rely entirely off the forest, the animals, the fruits. So the railway line, I've been there myself, when you lie in your hammock at night in an Awá community, you can hear these trains thundering by, the whole earth shakes, and this is frightening off the game. So if they double the railway line, this will bring even more problems to the Awá's hunting or their ability to feed themselves.
That this judge has now stopped or for the time put on hold this project, do you think that's kind of a victory?
Yes, I think it's very important because it is showing that the way these multinationals work is that they assume that they have the right almost to do what they like, and they have not consulted the Awá properly. And they need to sit down and really work out with the Awá, listen to them, hear what they have to say, and work out whether this is going to be possible or not. And I think what the judge is saying is, up to now, the company has not acted properly, it has not followed the law, and it certainly hasn't obtained the free, prior, and informed consent of the Awá to this railway line project.
Is this a typical case, the case of the Awá against a railroad and a mining company?
Yes, I think it's very typical. I mean, all over the world, survival is following cases where indigenous peoples are increasingly seeing their territories being invaded. They're being targeted by logging companies, multinational oil and gas companies, settlers, ranchers, all sorts of people. Or they're becoming, if you like, the people who are going to suffer most from these vast infrastructure projects. You know, many companies, for example, in Ethiopia and Brazil and Peru are building massive hydroelectric dams, which are going to result in the destruction of indigenous people's livelihood, their way of life, and in fact result in the loss of their lands and turning these people, you know, from self-sufficient people into people who are going to have absolutely nothing and become dependent probably on the nation state for food handouts. So this is certainly not development for them.
How effective are existing national and international rules to protect the rights of indigenous groups and tribal people?
Well, there is a convention drawn up by the International Labour Organization. It's known as Convention 169, which has some good provisions in it. For example, it obliges governments to recognize indigenous peoples land ownership rights, collective land ownership rights, which is very important because, and quite a few countries have signed this ILO 169, but the problem remains the enforcement. So, for example, in South America, where many countries have signed ILO 169, it's one thing to sign it on paper, but to actually enforce it on the ground is far more challenging. And so often you see these huge political and economic interests simply overriding the law. They may come out with very good rulings, but there will be judges on the ground who are bought off or who are corrupt. So it's very difficult often to get these rulings enforced.
Now, one of the arguments of, for instance, big commercial companies is often, well, the indigenous people also benefit from infrastructure projects.
Well, in my experience, it's extremely rare for indigenous peoples to benefit. For example, we've seen areas where there's hydroelectric dams. The people who live on the ground, the indigenous people or indeed other people, like, you know, peasant communities, still haven't got electricity. So far from benefiting, they're actually losing out because at the end of the day, they're losing their land. And I think the problem is that, you know, many nation states and companies look at indigenous peoples and make the automatic assumption that they buy into what we call development. Now, most indigenous peoples are not against development per se, but they want a development that is a development that they have a genuine stakehold in, a genuine say in, and that is going to support their communities. Of course they're going to develop. We know many communities who've got their own projects, very innovative projects, film projects, educational projects. For example, the Yanomami in the middle of the rainforest have vibrant schools. They're learning to read and write in their own language. They're learning the national language, Portuguese, in order to better defend their rights. That's the sort of development indigenous peoples want, not things that are imposed on them.
What exactly is it that you think tribal people can bring to the world?
I think they bring a fantastic example of how to live within your means, how to live sustainably off the natural resources. And generally, when they're on their own land, they are incredibly fulfilled and happy people. I mean, when I've gone into indigenous communities and I see how they really act together as a community, how they live off those resources, and they have plenty of time also for socialization. They lead happy, fulfilling lives, and they do not need aid. They are not dependent on the nation state, on the government, or foreign aid. And I think that's a fantastic example. They've also given us many things in terms of ethnobotany, their fantastic knowledge of plants, and they've contributed in that way to foodstuffs around the world, contributions to developing drugs, if you like, the pharmaceutical industry. They have this amazing knowledge. So these are very, in a way, very sophisticated societies. The problem is really coming from outside, where you have these massive forces stacked against them, you know, large multinational companies, greedy governments. That is really where the issue is. I think there will always be a need for a voice, for public opinion, and to get these issues into the media. Because if we say, as a society, as countries, or as businesses, that we want to respect human rights, and businesses have loads of, you know, reams of fancy papers and words on, you know, corporate social responsibility. If this has got to have any meaning, we have to call them to account.
Thank you very much and good luck with your work.
Thank you very much.
That was Fiona Watson from the rights group Survival International in London, talking about indigenous and tribal people. For more information on this issue, a longer version of the interview, and a really nice picture gallery on indigenous groups, please go to our website at dw.de/globalization. We're moving to Africa for our next report. Farmers in Santa, a farming commune in Cameroon's northwest region, are having mixed fortunes as rainfalls become unreliable. Some have abandoned their farms, turning to motorbike taxi riding as an alternative means of earning an income to feed their families. But others are adopting new methods of irrigating their crops. Our reporter in Galat, Kilian Chimtom, accompanied a Santa farmer to his farm on a motorbike to find out about ways to cope with the changing weather patterns.
Michael Tembene Tangwan is a farmer in Santa subdivision in Cameroon's northwest region. He has virtually lost hope in farming as rainfall becomes erratic and water sources are drying up. He now earns most of his income as a motorbike taxi rider. But he was willing to show me his remaining carrot and potato fields, some 15 hectares of mostly dry land now. Michael Tangwan, a man in his 40s, looks unhappy as he looks at his wilting crops and throws his hands up in the air in a sign of exasperation.
Actually, I cannot know what has happened with the water this year, because last year there was water and this year there's no water coming down. The stream have already dry, and I don't know what has made the stream to dry.
Yes.
A big river used to run through the fields here, but now we are walking on dry straw on the riverbed. The water is all gone. The rains have often failed in this part of the country, but this has never been accompanied by the drying up of rivers. So farmers here have been used to reverting to pressure-based irrigation. Olivier Foga, a Santa farmer, has done this many times over, taking water from the higher areas and bringing it down to the valleys.
The irrigation is free force. That is, we don't use petrol or any engine. The only problem we have now is the problem of scarcity of water.
But as streams dry up, farmers here find it hard to irrigate their farms. That's why many farmers like Tembene are now dismantling the irrigation systems they had set up, a system that consists of piping water to various parts of the farm and using sprinklers to water the crops.
I am removing the sprinkler because the water has already been low, cannot work anything.
The result of all this has been dwindling yields for farmers and diminishing family incomes. Tangwan has lost all his carrots this season.
Last year I harvest 360 bags, and this year there is no one.
Can you estimate the amount of money you made last year when you harvested the 360 bags of carrots?
When I sold all the crops, I reduced all the expenditure. I balanced about $1.5 million last year.
And today, nothing?
And today is nothing. I had nothing this year.
The dwindling water supply has put over 80% of farmers in the region off the farms, according to Cletus Awa, the Northwest Regional Delegate for Agriculture. But Tembene's neighbor would not let low rainfall defeat him. Kumbo Olivier Foga cultivates carrots, lettuce and cabbages. Unlike Tembene, he would not throw his hands up in the air in prayer and wait for the rains to come. He has resorted to constructing dams to capture the little available water. Although the river is dry, Kumbo Olivier's artificial water ponds will contain some of the rainwater he caught in April this year, water he can now use to irrigate his fields.
At noon, we block the pipes. The water enter the dam, then at night you open it. It will supply throughout the night. We construct dams. In terms of shortage, we manage like that. Many others, they just decide to just leave their farm like that.
A number of farmers here have joined Olivier in this approach, and such resilience comes with rising hope. While many others now abandon their farms, farmers like Kumbo Olivier, who are adapting to the situation, are hoping to take advantage of the scarcity on the market to boost their incomes.
I have a balance of about 2 million per year.
2 million francs or $4,000 isn't little money in a country where 40% of the people live below the poverty line, and his income could even be higher this year. The rising water scarcity in Santa reflects a larger national problem. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, annual rainfall in Cameroon has been dwindling by 2.5 millimeters every year since 1960. This has reduced the productive capacity of the soil, putting thousands of people on the verge of starvation. Earlier this year, the World Food Programme reported that about 400,000 people in the northern part of the country were threatened by hunger. A similar food crisis in 2008 led to violent uprisings that left 40 people dead. While global climate change is a big factor in the problems facing Cameroon's farmers, they also increasingly realize they carry part of the responsibility for the drying up of water sources.
To me, it is the felling down of trees that have caused the water to dry.
And what do you think should be done about it?
In our area now, forests are trying to replant trees that will regain the water supply.
A national tree planting campaign was started 3 years ago to mitigate climate change effects and to help restore shrinking water sources. But for many farmers in this part of Cameroon, the effects of the measures may come too late.
That was a report by Ngala Kilian Chimtom. Puberty can be a confusing time for young people, no matter where in the world they are. But for many girls in India, it can also mean long periods of absence from school. Sometimes they drop out, or they are even married off by their families. Meanwhile, in many parts of India, menstruation is culturally considered dirty and impure, and is surrounded by many myths and false beliefs. Although this situation is slowly improving in both rural and urban India, many myths and taboos around menstruation still exist. Pia Chindavaka finds out more.
tucked away beside a large public bus station in the heart of the city of Bangalore, the Yashwantpur slum is relatively quiet, with most of its residents away at work or school. 14-year-old Kausalya Velayudham sits alone at the doorway of her one-room tenement, washing clothes. Kausalya belongs to a family of migrant labourers from the state of Tamil Nadu. She shares this tenement with two siblings, a widowed aunt and her three cousins. Kausalya's father abandoned the family and her mother returned to their native village, leaving Kausalya and her brothers to the care of her aunt Lalita. While Lalita works as a domestic helper during the day, Kausalya helps out by doing all the household chores. But washing clothes at noon is a change from her usual routine, she says.
Usually I have to be in school by 9 a.m. So I wake up early, cook the food, wash the dishes and finish all my morning jobs before I leave for school. I wash the clothes only when I come back from school in the evening.
For the past few days, Kausalya has not been going to school. She got her period for the first time. As is a common tradition in many parts of India, Kausalya was made to sit outside the house for 5 days at a stretch. She sat at the doorway under a temporary shelter made of banana leaves.
I was not supposed to come inside. I could come inside only to sleep. Even then, I had to sleep near the door and not come further inside. All of God's photos in our house were covered with a cloth, and I was not supposed to look at them for 9 days. They said God will get angry.
Although she was allowed to come inside the house after the first 5 days, Kausalya has other restrictions, which she has to follow for 9 days as per the tradition. She is not allowed to leave the slum to protect her against evil spirits. But since the tenement they live in has only a small bathing area and no toilet, Kausalya is allowed to go once a day to the public toilet at the nearby bus station, which is used by all the slum dwellers. Here too, Kausalya was told to cover her face with her dupatta or scarf.
The boys and men around the bus station shouldn't see my face. I have got my period for the first time. If anyone sees me, they will say I will get pimples all over my face.
Apart from this list of instructions, Kausalya knows little else about the changes in her body. All she knows from her aunt and teachers at school is that she is a big girl now and has to be careful around boys and strangers, although no one has told her why. Meanwhile, about half a kilometre away, Kausalya's school, the TA Higher Primary, is in full swing. Kausalya's classmate, Shalini Bhavu, recites along with the rest of the children. It was during a class like this one day, around 7 months ago, that her friends discovered she was bleeding. Her teacher sent Shalini home, where her mother told her that she had got her period. Like Kausalya, Shalini also had to go through the ritual of sitting outside for 5 days. As per ancient Hindu tradition, this practice was followed so that women would get a break from the housework. But over the years, the practice began to be interpreted differently. Women and girls were told that their bodies were polluted during this time, so they had to sit away from others and avoid chores like cooking so that they didn't contaminate others. Today, the practice still continues in many parts of India, especially in rural areas and in poor or less educated families. But this is only when the girl has her first period. Shalini now continues to come to school, but she often has to miss a few days every month, complaining of severe stomachache and heavy bleeding. She says she hasn't gone to a doctor as yet.
My mother told my aunt that I was bleeding severely, but my aunt said that I don't need to go to a doctor. She just told her to give me some nuts, sweets and spicy food, and the bleeding would slow down.
Shalini has her parents' support to continue coming to school. But this is not the case for many other girls in India. It's estimated that up to a quarter of Indian girls drop out of school for good after they reach adolescence, or they stay away from school during their menstruation because they cannot afford proper menstrual protection like sanitary napkins. Also, many parents take their daughters out of school when they hit puberty and start planning to get them married. One of the reasons is the fear that they might become pregnant at an early age, especially since there have been cases in Bangalore of older men taking advantage of adolescent girls in schools. Teachers at the TA Higher Primary School say they have not had cases of dropouts in their school, although they admit they sometimes have to go to students' homes and convince the parents to send their daughters to school. Shalini's English teacher, Shanti Bhaskaran, feels it would help to equip the girls with more awareness on how to behave around strangers and how to identify sex abuse, so that they can prevent or report such incidents. Yet, she says, a complete education on the female anatomy, puberty-related changes and sexuality would not be appropriate. Discussing these issues openly is not part of Indian culture, says Shanti.
The children watch TV and know too much nowadays. If we just casually mention the word love or affection in class, they start getting all kinds of wrong ideas. We don't feel comfortable discussing these things in detail. My personal opinion is that we don't need sex education. If there is a need to educate them about the do's and don'ts of sexual behavior, let other people come and teach them. But as a teacher, I don't feel it's necessary.
Early this year, the state of Karnataka, of which Bangalore is the capital, introduced sex education in the school curriculum. But whether it will be easily accepted and implemented by teachers and school authorities in the state remains to be seen. Pia Chandavarkar, DW, Bangalore.
And our last story today takes us to Cambodia. When the Khmer Rouge took power in Cambodia in 1975, they began a radical experiment to remake the country into an agrarian utopia. The result was the deaths of up to 2 million people. They were starved, executed, sometimes worked to death. Artists and musicians were especially hated by the regime. It's estimated that as many as 90% of them were killed. Although the Khmer Rouge were driven from power in 1979, their brutal attack on the arts can be felt to this day. Some traditional forms of art were completely lost, and many still hover on the verge of extinction. But as Carl James reports from Phnom Penh, one group is working to save endangered art forms before it's too late.
In a house just outside the capital, a group of teenagers sits in a semicircle around an older man. They all hold a two-stringed, long-necked instrument, the Chapai Dongweng. The young people watch and listen closely as the man in front of them, Suan San, brings the instrument to life. Suan San is 61 years old now. But, as he explains, just as a rainy season downpour starts outside, he's been playing the chapai since he was 18 years old in rural Cambodia.
I liked the instrument when I was young, and I liked singing in the fields. So I learned it and would play when someone calls me to play at a ceremony like the blessing of a new house.
But that changed radically in 1975 when the Khmer Rouge came to power. The country's cities were emptied out and everyone forced to work on collective farms. Certain groups were targeted as undesirable, such as intellectuals, artists, and musicians. They didn't fit into Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot's image of a new Cambodia. It was one where history was to be reset at year zero. The country was to be freed from outside influence and any remnant of what they considered decadent culture.
If Pol Pot or someone knew about my chapai singing, they would kill me. So I threw the instrument away so no one would know I had it. I didn't tell anyone I could play it.
The effect on the country's artistic landscape was disastrous. When the Vietnamese drove the Khmer Rouge from power in 1979, most artists and musicians were dead, in exile, or still too frightened and scared to practice their craft again. As the years passed, lesser-known art forms began to die out. The nation's cultural heritage was diminishing.
It's the loss of the past of who I am. So it's very confused and for me, and also sadness and also anger, of course.
Arn Chorn Pond, the founder of Cambodia Living Arts. The group's aim is to preserve performing art forms that were almost wiped out in the 1970s. It's his group that found Chapai player Suen San and arranged for him to teach the instrument to young people. Arn Chornpan knows firsthand just how important the arts can be. In fact, music saved his life. He was chosen by a Khmer Rouge brigade when he was just 10 or 11 to play propaganda songs on the Kim, a hammered dulcimer.
One thing I'm sure is if it didn't save me from the Khmer Rouge killing, the music would really save me mentally. Because I remember many times when I couldn't take it, you know. I was really happy to be able to play the Kim. It sounds really nice when you play. After a while, you close your eyes and it just takes you out some other world, you know, takes you out somewhere. So every day I was able to escape through the sound of music instead of the sound of screaming all around me.
Then, one year later in 1998, he saw a disheveled, drunk woman sitting in a gutter in Phnom Penh. He recognized her as one of the nation's great opera singers from the 1960s. That's when he said to himself, something had to be done. So he began a search around the country for artists, offering them stipends so they could devote themselves to their arts. Cambodia Living Arts is headed today by Plun Prem, who said the organization's founding came just in time.
Cambodian culture and art has almost been always an oral transmission. So musicians, when you see them playing, they don't know notation. They play by ear. And it has been passed on from generations to generations to generations. And so when a master passes away with his skill, then it's the whole art form that is dying.
He himself is surprised to find so many young people interested in these traditional art forms that include singing, dancing, and other instruments, especially when Western and Korean pop are so popular here. But he thinks young people are attracted for other reasons as well.
Cambodia getting out of the genocide, we lost a whole generations. So there's not much connection in between the young and the elder because you lost the father that were maybe in between. So to recreate that kind of connection is because it's not just about learning an art form, but it's about connecting generation with another.
Back at Suen San's house, his students get ready to play a song they've been practicing for 3 months now. 18-year-old Song Sung Chumpa says she's learning to play the chapai because her father did.
There are only a few people learning the instrument, and it's not very popular anymore. So I want to preserve it, and I don't want it to be lost. People should know about it.
It'll be some time before these students get to the level of San Suen. Still, thanks to Cambodia Living Arts, his instrument will not be silenced forever, despite the horrors of the Khmer Rouge. And he can do what he loves best and pass it along to others, keeping an ancient part of Cambodian culture alive. Kyle James, DW, Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
That report from Kyle James in Phnom Penh wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. If you want to listen to these and other reports again, go to our webpage at dw.de/globalization. Thanks for joining me today. Next week, my colleague Sarah Steffen will be back with more development stories from around the world. On behalf of today's studio team here in Bonn, Marian Kulina and Eliane Giaducci, I'm Anke Rasper saying thanks for listening and goodbye.
ពុជជានីបកលកាផ្ទះហើយគ្រប់វេលាទៅឲ្យភរិយាជាមេត្រប់មុខងារដាំស្លអង្គបាយចំណូលចំណាយទីប្រាំទៀននុបទៀននេនៃអ្នកកប់ឲ្យគ្រឿងស្លៀកពាក់គ្រប់ប្រដាប់ល្អល្អចំណាប់ហើយថ្មីថ្មី